A stranger with a gun came upon two teens taking pictures under a rising full moon. But violence is only the beginning of this story.
Sometimes I thought, there are no miracles. Yeah, there are, and this is a big one.
I'm Amy Donaldson, and I've spent my career talking about how lives are undone by violence. The Letter is a podcast about how lives are remade. Follow The Letter at theletterpodcast.com or wherever you get your podcasts.
In today's episode of Project Recovery...
So my parents had to tell me what had happened, that I didn't have legs and that I was paralyzed. And when they told me, I knew that I would be okay. And that's what kept going through my mind, was that I'll be okay. Like, that's the honest answer.
Make sure you listen to the end. Find us on Facebook at Project Recovery. We'll have that and much more coming up. Hey, welcome to Project Recovery, a podcast about addiction, but more importantly, it's about recovery. And it's brought to you by our friends at knowyourscript.org. They're helping you talk to yourself, talk to your doctor, talk to your family about your prescription, because there's so many people, Dr. Matt, that have come to our podcast who got into their addiction through a legal prescription.
I think that might be the number one avenue that we've had on the show. Surgery, injury, something like that, and then they take the pills and they're hooked.
We recently just had a guest on, I think in the past 3 weeks. Her name was Tony Carroll, Tony with an I. Mm-hmm. And she was very anti-drugs, anti-alcohol.
No alcohol, nothing, yeah.
And always took her job as a cheerleader and what she did as a role model very, very seriously. Mm-hmm. Fast forward to 5 kids and sleepless nights and migraine headaches, prescribed some opioids. And
right. Did you know that there is now a new law for prescribers where if they are prescribing a Schedule 2 or 3 drug, which would be like a benzodiazepine or an opioid or a heavy sleep med, they actually have to contact the other doctors who are prescribing. So they have to communicate now. Isn't that cool?
I think that's amazing.
That's part of the Know Your Script. I mean, the doctors now have to communicate with each other just like we're trying to communicate with them.
And I think that shows you the seriousness of this epidemic that's really going on and taking hold in here in Utah and across the country, that we're actually getting proactive. And that's what they're all about, is knowing your script. So knowyourscript.org, thank you very much for allowing us to do this. Now, the first part of the show is where Dr. Matt and I kind of talk about things that are going on in our lives. Usually that's where I share things that are going on in my recovery. I wanted to tell you something, Dr. Matt, and I know I sent you this, but my girlfriend, the lovely Leslie.
Right. Yep.
Her daughter, Addie, who's a senior at Fremont, and she's going to play into this a little bit later on with our guest, who I'm very excited to have here today. We're going to talk about her in just a second, but her name's Addie Harris. And so she chose this assignment, and I'll just read you. Goes, this year I've chosen to take Communications 2110. In this class, we are assigned to do a project on social justice topic that happens within the community. We have chosen our topic surrounding alcoholism. And, you know, she's been with me since the day one of sobriety.
Right. And is that why she chose this topic, do you think?
I'd have to think so. You know, I mean, I don't think – that's the thing, is I don't think a lot of seniors in high school are talking about alcoholism.
No, not unless it's touched their lives through maybe family members, but their own experience – is pretty unlikely to be.
But I think it's evident of the popularity of my daughter's letter that it really has happening a lot more than we know of. And
sure.
And people aren't talking about
it. Well, what do we say? Alcoholism is a family disease.
Yes, it is. Yeah. And so she's doing this thing, and she wanted to send us some questions. So I thought we'd answer some of her questions right here on air.
Let's do it.
And then we'll finish them. So the first one is for you, Dr. Matt. Do you find most people who struggle with addiction is in their families, who are ones that want them to get help, or most, or themselves? Does that make sense?
No, not at all.
I messed it up. So,
is it the family members that want them to get help, or do they want to get help?
Yeah.
That's the essence of the question.
You got it.
Right. I would say most of the time it's family members, because most people who have an addiction, it takes some experiences, usually some pretty heavy ones, before they realize they need some help. And people don't like to talk about feeling weak or powerless. And if you're addicted to anything, you do feel powerless.
I use the term broken. because for the longest time, I thought I was broken. I would see so many people who seemed to have it all together, who could sit down at a dinner, have two cocktails, and walk away. Mm-hmm. I would sit on my back deck and wonder why I was broken. And then that would lead me to try to negotiate with my sobriety. I would try to outthink my addiction, and I tried everything possible to try to fix it. And rather than
on your own, right?
Yeah. And then rather than just accept it.
Right.
I think that one. So the next question is also for you, Dr. Matt. What is one thing all addicts, for the most part, have in common?
Oh, that's a great question.
Is there something?
Well, that's a hard one, because I think people do have a very individual experience with their addiction. But there are some commonalities. One is it may run in their family. And the more families talk about it, the more you know if you're going to be at risk. Your children should know if addiction runs in your family. If Grandpa or Uncle Billy or whoever had a problem with it, it's important to talk about that. I would also say a lot of addicts, people have they may be self-medicating for something. So in my world of psychology, mental health, a lot of people who are struggling with an addiction, it started with covering up depression or anxiety. And so if we can get to the root of those things, people don't need to self-medicate. But those are a couple of thoughts.
And see, my mind instantaneously goes to trauma. We've been doing this podcast for over 2 years, mm-hmm. and I would say probably more than half of our guests who have been addicted to some sort of substance, it all began with a trauma.
That's certainly very common. I agree.
And so, people ask me, why did I become an alcoholic? And I go, well, first off, nobody chooses to become an alcoholic.
Right.
I didn't have any trauma that led me down the road. When I started drinking, it was for fun. And in the beginning, it was fun. But then it became a way for me to cope with hard situations, for feelings, to numb out things. I would just say life, because I wasn't able to deal with them on my own. And I'm not blaming anybody else, but I was never taught how to deal.
We've talked quite a few times that you and I grew up in a generation where you just kind of rub some dirt on it, walk it off. We weren't really encouraged to talk about our feelings or seek help for emotional things. Right?
I can tell you this sentence was uttered more than once at my house. Dad, I think I need to go to the hospital. Are you bleeding? No. Then you don't need to go to the hospital.
Yeah. He must have talked to my dad, because my dad said that too.
But then you want to flip that and, but if you break your arm, you go to the hospital. Yeah. But if you feel like there's something broken in your head, you don't think the same thing. You think, I'll just figure this out.
But, the funny thing is that wasn't your dad or my dad's fault either, because they grew up in a generation of the same sort of thing. I think we're finally at a point where addiction and mental health issues have become so prevalent in society that people are now really talking about them. And we know it's okay if not completely necessary, we should be talking about those things in our homes. So I think it's changed a lot just in the last 20 years, and that's great.
So the next question is for me, and this is kind of a doozy. It says, do you feel like yourself have changed into a different person after becoming sober?
If you have changed into a different person.
Have I changed into a different person? And I think the short answer is no. Because I think I was always this person. I think I've become a better person because I've gotten sober. But I still say things I shouldn't. I'm still a little bit irreverent. I'm still a little bit loud. I'm technically the same person. But I can tell you one of the reasons why I hesitated to get sober was because I thought I would be a different person.
Oh, you did?
I wondered if I would still be this gregarious guy, if I would still be up for anything, if I'd still mm-hmm. be willing to do the things that I did, because I'd say it was alcohol courage. Does that make sense?
Oh, yeah. Yeah,
and
completely.
So I wonder.
I would agree with you, though. I think you're essentially, we've known each other a long time, mm-hmm. and I think you're essentially just a better version of the same guy.
And so, I don't think that I've turned into a different person. And I think a lot of times people wonder that, am I going to be a different person? Am I still going to be able to be who I was? Because when we had people who sit down in this chair, and I can't remember their names, but we've had so many guests that when they were young, alcohol gave them the chance to be a little more outgoing.
Liquid courage.
They were able to do those things, and it made them feel different. It helped them get out of their skin, out of their head, and be the person they always wanted to be. Now, I'll tell you, that person was always there, Mm-hmm. You were given alcohol unfair credit because it just it lowered your inhibitions a little bit to show something that was always in there.
And that you're describing a person with an anxiety disorder, right? Somebody who's got so much anxiety that they have a hard time letting themselves be authentic and genuine and outgoing. And the alcohol can kind of, you know, dampen that anxiety reaction, and then they feel like they can be themselves. I talk to people about that all the time.
You know, for the longest time, and I still do it, I DJ weddings. And I've always been so impressed at the dancing that goes on in a Mormon wedding.
Yeah.
Because, I mean, I look out there and I go, you guys are tearing it up. You guys are dancing everywhere and you're completely sober. You know, and
you're impressed because they're sober.
They're sober.
And they can still dance.
And they're having a great time.
Yeah.
Because I've also DJed parties where alcohol is a factor.
Yeah.
And that party and dance floor doesn't get popping until they get drunk. Because they need that to help them let loose.
Yeah, interesting observation.
And so, yeah. I mean, I would sit there and I was like, Mormon weddings are the best. You know, because these guys are just out there getting crazy and having fun and not a care in the world. And
everyone will still feel good the next day.
Yes. And I always said to myself, I was like, why can't I do that? Now I know I can.
Now you can. But the problem is, I think for a lot of people like you, you started drinking when you were a teenager.
Yeah, 14.
And so all of your real development, your, you know, adolescence and adult development, alcohol was a factor. So, of course, you would wonder, would I still be the same person without it? Because you haven't really done a whole lot without it.
No, from 14 until 45, alcohol was right by my side through most of my whole entire life.
Mm-hmm.
And everything that I learned to do, I learned to do with alcohol. I told you, I didn't know sober softball was a thing until I got into rehab. I was like, wait a minute, you guys play softball sober?
How about golfing?
Golf! I was like, that what? This is crazy. But you know what? My golf game's gotten better. I still can't swing a bat, but I can run the bases without getting winded, you know? And so there's a lot of things happening.
Yeah.
And so I would say to Addie in her question, do I think I'm a different person? No, I think I'm the same person. I'm just a better version.
Yeah, I would agree with that.
We'll do one more question, then we're going to move on to our guest. How did your addiction make you feel about yourself?
And you sort of answered. You talked about that a little bit already.
And for the longest part, it made me feel broken. And I've said it a lot of times on this podcast. The first time I didn't feel alone was when I was in an AA room with 200 people
mm-hmm.
that just couldn't figure it out like I did. I often beat myself up because I was doing cool things on TV. I had a wonderful marriage. I had 3 kids. I was very, very blessed. But I was handcuffed to alcohol. And I said it on 2 podcasts ago, I fought for alcohol harder in my life than anything else. And that made me feel bad.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't like that about me. And now I fight for life harder than I fight for anything. And it's...
Addiction is a self-esteem killer. It really does destroy a person's self-esteem because you feel powerless, like you said, handcuffed to something. You don't feel in control of yourself. Feeling good about oneself has to do with owning and recognizing your accomplishments and your abilities, feeling confident in yourself. And addiction takes that away from a person. And so I don't think there is anybody who has ever struggled with addiction that wouldn't agree with the fact that their self-esteem goes down exponentially over the years as they feel more and more sort of a victim of their own addiction.
You know, I'm 45 and I just thought of this. My longest relationship.
You're 47.
Oh, yeah, 47. I'm from Ogden. I'm not great at math. But my longest relationship is with alcohol.
Yeah.
And, you know, when I'm glad I'm done with that relationship. But when I broke up with her, it was tough.
Yeah.
And I'm looking forward to life. I love this podcast. I love what we do. And I want to say thank you for doing this with me and Josh and KSL and everybody for allowing me to do this. I'm getting a little nervous, and you can tell it because I start to run my words together, because our guest today is an amazing young lady.
She's very, very excited to have her on the show.
She's 18 years old. She's 4 years older than when I first started drinking.
Yeah.
I talked to her dad about a month ago. We've been planning this, and I told her dad, we're 2 sides of the same coin. And you're going to understand why I say that when I introduce you. Her name is Sarah Fry. And Sarah, I think you're amazing. And before we find out more about your story, let's find out about your upbringing. Tell me a little something about Sarah.
So I'm the youngest of six kids, and I love having a big family. I'm a cheerleader, and I've been a cheerleader for about 7 years. I'm a senior in high school. I just have a lot of friends that I love. Yeah, that's a little bit about me.
And your life changed last summer. How did your life change?
So last summer, at the end of July, I was coming home from Bear Lake, and we were going through the Logan Canyon. I was with three other friends in a little sedan, and we were heading home, and I mean, I don't know if you've been through the Logan Canyon.
Yeah, I went to Utah State. We would go up there all the time.
Yeah, so it's pretty... Well,
it's notorious for being... They sometimes call it Sardine Canyon, right? It's is that the right one?
No. Sardine Canyon's the canyon below. Logan Canyon's is the canyon above.
Okay.
And so Sardine will take you from Brigham City to Logan.
Yeah.
Logan Canyon will take you from Logan to
Bear Lake. You're right. Okay.
Yeah, so it's super narrow and tight. And we were just driving along. I was in the back passenger seat, and we were hit head-on by a drunk driver. They estimated he was going about 70 miles per hour around the bend, and there was nowhere for my friend Tavy, who was driving. There was nowhere for her to go because there was a cliff on one side and a mountain on the other side. When he hit us head-on, I was instantly paralyzed from the waist down. And started internally bleeding. I mean, there was no cell service in the canyon either. And so we stayed in that canyon for about an hour before the ambulance came. Luckily, someone had a satellite phone, which is just a huge miracle that someone there had a satellite phone, because I don't know anyone who even has a satellite phone. So the ambulance finally came, and we were all sent to the hospital. I was then life-flighted to Primary Children's because they realized how bad my injuries were.
Can I stop you there for a second?
Yeah.
You guys were there an hour before the ambulance even showed up. What was going on during that hour? Do you remember things? Was it a blur? Walk me through that.
Yeah, so I don't remember much about the accident. I remember, like, little snippets. I remember being, like, hunched over, and I was looking at the floor, and I kept trying to... My friend Brooke, who was right in front of me in the passenger seat, she was holding out her hand behind her, and I kept trying to grab it, but, like, I couldn't move. Like, I felt so weak all of a sudden, and I felt like I couldn't breathe, and... The people there helping who came to our aid, they were asking me questions. I think trying to keep me, like, away, kind of. They were asking me, like, when my birthday was and all this other stuff. And I just remember, like, not caring about any of those questions. I kept saying, like, I can't breathe and, like, I don't know when my birthday is. Like, I don't really care. So that's about all that I remember. From that, I remember a little bit about the ambulance ride, them telling me a number, and I had to remember the number that they told me.
What was the number?
21. And, yeah, and that's about all I remember.
And then they air-flighted you to Primary Children's.
Yeah, which I don't remember any of the helicopter ride or anything.
Can you tell us about your friends and what was their experience in the accident?
Yeah, so the driver, because she was slamming on the brakes so hard, when the impact happened, she broke her femur, and it was a really bad break. The windshield was touching their faces, the two girls in the front. So that's how bad the car was smashed. The girl in the front passenger seat. She had many abdominal and back injuries, kind of just pains mostly. The boy sitting next to me, his name is Josh, he broke his collarbone and cracked his pelvis. But he was the one that could get out of the car. He saw the car kind of smoking, so he wanted to make sure that nothing would catch on fire. And he just was going around. He tried getting us out, but we were all pretty much trapped.
Mm. It's miraculous that no one lost their life.
I know. Just recently, we went to Logan and talked to the paramedics who
went to the fire station that dispatched the ambulances.
Oh.
I got to talk with the paramedics who were in her ambulance and in the other ambulance. But because of – so they literally saved her life. She was internally bleeding so quickly and so profusely – that had they gone by the book from what the protocol and the manual says to do, which was to administer an IV, had they done that, it would have the homeostasis would have leveled to the extent that her heart, it wouldn't have pumped blood through and she would have died. But they had a gut feeling to not do the IV, so they went with their gut, and that's what saved her.
Wow.
Along with the fact that there was an off-duty paramedic that was on site with a neck brace, there was a pharmacist, there was another a special ops guy that was trained in medical situations. So these kids had these good Samaritans that were highly medically trained. But for her, they saved her life, literally saved her life.
They said that when they first saw the accident, they knew that no one would be alive.
So, were you guys all wearing your seatbelts?
Yes, we all had our seatbelts on properly.
I hear you telling that story. And in my situation, could have ended up like that. And it makes me feel so ashamed of what I did and the people that I hurt because of my selfish action. That, I mean, it was selfish. I was doing an interview lately, and I said when I set out that day, I didn't have any malicious intent. Like, I didn't set out to hurt anybody. But getting behind the wheel of a car while intoxicated was the most malicious thing I could have ever done.
I find it so cool that you're able to admit that and talk about it.
And I'm not proud. And I think of the family and the people that I hurt every day. And I hope one day to be able to sit down and talk with them. I hate that their pain is a part of my story. I hate the fact that they had to get hurt for me to get sober. I wish I could have done it a different way. But like we talked before the mics went on, I can't live in the past. There's nothing I can do to change it. All I can do is be better than I was and keep moving forward. That's why I'm so excited for you to be here, because your attitude and your resilience and the way you look at life is an inspiration to so many people out there. I wish I wasn't an alcoholic, but I am. You could sit there and say, I wish I wasn't hurt in the car, but you did. And so then life gives you a choice. And I'm sure you contemplated things, you know, what to do, or maybe you didn't. I kind of want to know when they said, you're paralyzed, what was your first thought?
So it's actually kind of a crazy story. So once I got to the hospital, they realized that I wasn't getting any blood flow to either of my legs, and they would both need to be amputated above the knee. And so they did that surgery, and then I don't remember the first 2 weeks of when I was at the hospital because I was so heavily sedated and constantly in and out of surgeries. So my parents had to tell me what had happened, that I didn't have legs and that I was paralyzed. And so they had to tell me, and I mean, it's kind of cool, my reaction, because when they told me, I knew that I would be okay. And that's what kept going through my mind, was that I'll be okay. And like, that's the honest answer, was that I could like see my life. I just knew that I would be able to live my life. I don't know. It was just cool that I wasn't like scared or anything like that. So that was my first kind of reaction.
You had a calming reassurance.
Yeah.
That your life was going to be okay.
Yeah.
That's amazing.
Yeah.
That's amazing. Has it persisted this year? Has that been the feeling, or has it come and gone?
Yeah, that's definitely been the overall feeling. I mean, everyone has their hard days. I mean, we all, people who go through things probably always ask why me, all that stuff. But I feel like I've been able to help so many people because of my experiences. And that's what I love mostly. And that's one of the reasons like that makes me so happy, and what's making my life so amazing. So yeah, the thought that I'll be okay and that I'll be happy has definitely kept going.
You're listening to Project Recovery. We're talking to a beautiful young lady who's an inspiration to so many out there, and I want to find out more from her. We're going to hear that in just a second. Stick around. We're Project Recovery. We'll be right back.
2 years ago, Americans watched in horror as a crisis unfolded at the Kabul airport.
She was tear-gassed and beaten.
Images of thousands desperate to escape Taliban oppression filled our news feeds. More than 80,000 Afghans made it to America. But the story didn't end there.
It was very cold. There was no power, no heat.
Who would help our newest neighbors? I'm Andrea Smartin. In Stranger Becomes Neighbor, you'll hear the stories of some remarkable refugees who left their homes and their dreams behind, only to start over from zero.
Their only possession was 3 blankets.
And you'll meet Americans who stepped up to help them.
You want me to come when you deliver your baby?
What can one person do in the face of an international disaster decades in the making? That's Stranger Becomes Neighbor. Find us at kslpodcast.com. Follow us on Apple Podcasts or anywhere else you listen.
Welcome back to Project Recovery. I'm Casey Scott. That's Dr. Matt Woolley. He's a clinical psychologist. Our guest today is Sarah Fry and her father, Greg Fry. As we heard in the first segment, she talked about what happened when they got hit head on in Logan Canyon by a drunk driver. In your own words, you woke up 2 weeks later in Primary Children's Hospital with your parents telling you that you lost your legs. And your first reaction was, it's going to be okay. Which Dr. Matt said was a calming, soothing sensation that you just felt all over your body. Which is amazing, because I don't know if I would have that frame of mind or that in me to say, I'm going to be okay.
Yeah.
I think you're right. I think so many people want to shout at the top of the lungs and go, why me? But as we've learned, we can't go back and change that. So now what do we do with that information? And I've been following you ever since this happened. And
I have a quick story. Can
you
share it?
Yes.
Okay, so
anything to shut me up.
No. So you keep saying, like, we can't go change the past. We just have to focus on what's next, kind of. So before the accident, my brother and I were, like, best friends. He's 2 years older than me. And right before I turned 16, so he was 17 or 18, he could drive and I couldn't, and so he would drive me everywhere. And one day we were coming home from school, and he was driving, I was in the front seat, and there was all, he had to go to work, but he had to take me home first and then go to work. And there was all of this traffic in front of us, and I was getting so mad that there was all of this traffic, and because he was going to be late for work, and I felt so bad he had to take me home, and I was just getting so mad. And he was like, Sarah, there's nothing we can do to control this traffic, so you don't need to be upset by it because, I mean, I'm going as fast as I can. Like, there's nothing we can do. And after that, like, my whole mindset going into high school totally changed. Like, even my friends were like, Sarah, you've been so happy lately. And it's just because I just kept thinking of, like, if I can't control it, then I'm not going to, like, spend my time being upset by it if there's nothing I can do to control it. And so after the accident, that one memory has just been so special to me because it means so much to me now because there's nothing I can do except for focus on the future. And yeah, because what happened happened, and now it's just, I just have to figure out what to do next.
That,
how did you get so wise?
Well, I was going to say, pump the brakes. Who is this 17-year-old boy that has the wisdom? Like, 17-year-old boys are notoriously stupid.
I know. He's right? Amazing.
Like, he sounds like your older brother's, you know, Buddha's driving you around or something. I'm impressed with that. And isn't that special when an experience can come back time and time again? Something we've had in our past can come back and help guide us in our future. And the fact that that you and your brother have that close relationship, and that he could be the wise 17-year-old boy, which, you know, they're one in a million. And then for you to be able to hold on to that and have it guide you going forward, I think that's just a tremendously special experience.
Yeah, it was like I was prepared for this.
When tragedy struck you and your three friends coming home from Bear Lake, I remember watching it. I know my girlfriend's daughter participated in it. The community really rallied around you guys.
Mm-hmm.
Tell me a little bit about that and what it meant to you.
So when I was in the hospital, I'm a cheerleader, like I said, and my cheerleaders made a little dance for me, and they performed it at every single football game, halftime.
In honor of you.
In honor of me, and it was to my favorite song called Home Sweet, and it was just such an amazing routine. And then soon other schools' cheerleaders started learning it, and then, like, by the end of the football season, every school in our district, their cheerleaders all knew the dance, and they would all perform it together. And so when I came home from the hospital, there was, like, a little parade thing for me, and people were lining the streets, like, a mile long, leading to my house, and we were in a little side-by-side, and there were all of the cheerleaders, and they all did the dance for me, and it was so cool. I was crying so hard. So, yeah.
Well, you gave Casey goosebumps. I can see him from over here.
Yes.
She's being very humble. The cheer squad was going to be out front as she drove home from the hospital after 75 days in the hospital. That was the goal. Word spread, and more schools wanted to participate. So it started getting to be a bigger and bigger event. And then the sports teams wanted, the football team, the wrestlers from our Clearfield High and other schools wanted to join and be there. And then it just started to spread. And then the fire department got involved and this police escort. And so we had to do a mile-long route to the house. And so they were doing the cheers all the way down the street to her house and just gave her the most fabulous welcome home that you could ever ask for. So it's been amazing how this has just caught fire with people. The come back from the ashes type of story.
Now you're listening to the voice of Greg. Keep the mic there, Greg. And let's hear a little bit about your perception or what your thought process was from the first time you got the call that your daughter had been in an accident.
Yeah. So, It's interesting. Our neighbor down the street is a paraplegic or quadriplegic from a motorcycle accident that I was on with him just 5 days before her accident. And I watched him crash on
you were
I-15.
Riding,
I was riding with him.
And he crashed.
And he crashed. And he's a quad and on a ventilator. And that night, July 30th, Thursday night, I was talking with a friend in our neighborhood, and I said, if you could offer him the opportunity to be only paraplegic and not be on a ventilator,
which is waist down,
he would take that in a heartbeat. And not 2 minutes later, my phone rings, and it's the hospital up in Logan saying, your daughter has been in a car accident, and she's lost feeling in her from her waist down. We weren't sure what that meant, but we knew it was serious, and paralysis wasn't going through our mind because we're in denial. We're in shock. Everything's going to be okay. This can't be happening. Each progressive phone call after that got worse and worse until they said they were going to be life-flighting her, and we met him down at the hospital, and helicopter got there as we were pulling up. We saw it land on the roof, but because of COVID, we weren't allowed in. So that started just a life, for the next two or three months. Only because she was a minor were we allowed one parent in at a time, and we would rotate every 24 hours, my wife and I. And so we were blessed to be able to be with her. But I can tell you the power of time to let things heal and let the wounds, our mind was in such a fog. We were being lifted and sustained by friends and neighbors, certainly by our faith, regardless of your religion. Those founding principles of whatever religion you are is what sustains you in hardship. And we saw that happen. But there's something about time and just letting some perspective happen in your life that when you can look back and we can see how blessed we were and how things generally aren't as bad as you think they're going to be at the time that you're in it. And we've seen that with her. We just thought this was going to be the end of the world. And it's turned out to be such a miraculous blessing to us to see her positive attitude, the influence that she's having on others. But her strength and will is just such an inspiration to us as parents. It's really, really helped us. But like I was mentioning to you before, I lost interest in all of my hobbies. Didn't want to go fishing, didn't want to ride motorcycles, didn't want to run. And if I did try, one day I did try to go on a run, and I thought, how am I doing this? It was my day off. People were saying, you got to go do the things that are important to you and take care of yourself. But I tried going on a jog, and I thought, my daughter's in the hospital. She's paralyzed. She doesn't have any legs. How can I do this? I can't do this. And so that's been a learning opportunity for me to realize the importance of taking care of yourself. But I still don't have that interest in many things. I'm hoping it'll come back. But I don't know, maybe you have something to say on that.
Well, I mean, you're going, this has only been less than a year, and everybody in the family is going to be going through something similar to what we call the process of grief, even though, we're lucky that no lives were lost, lives were changed. And so having the term is called anhedonia, where you lose interest in the things that used to bring you joy and satisfaction. You do them and you kind of feel, it will come back. Partly it's as you realize that life is different now, but life is still good. And it's okay for all of us to indulge in self-care. And that's not really, shouldn't be an indulgence, but it probably feels like it's indulging something now to go for a run or do some of the things you used to enjoy. But as life continues to go on and as everyone adjusts and as you find new meaning in the lives and as your family kind of moves forward, yes, I do believe that that'll come back for you. And I assume other people in the family might be going through similar things. But yeah, there is a fancy word called anhedonia.
And Greg, I think you said it. I think it's time. I think it's time.
I think it's time, but I think it's also perspective. Time is essential. Most people wish time wasn't essential because you want to hurry and speed it up, right? Time is essential, but it's also looking for that new perspective, attaching your mind to accepting the way things are now. And and both of you have talked about this is a, well, I'll say this is a tough way for this to happen. But her influence over others has been tremendous, and her ability to encourage and find purpose and meaning in her life. And I think as everyone adjusts and their perspective accepts that there's a meaning here, then the feelings of depression and anhedonia and related hopelessness and things will fade away. Time is, of course, essential, but it's also how we adjust and accept the new life.
Yeah.
Sarah, I want to go back to you. What was the song that the cheerleaders danced to? Your favorite song?
Yeah, it's Home Sweet by Russell Dickerson.
Now, that song, Home Sweet, comes back around for you in a different way. Tell me about that.
So we posted, so I kept watching their halftime performances every Friday night in my hospital bed, just on my phone. And one of my strengths in cheer is learning choreography very quickly and picking up on things. So, I mean, as I would watch this over and over, I started to learn it just by watching. And so one day my mom, she kind of started filming me because the song came on and she started filming me and I was just doing the dance that they had done for me. And we posted it on our social media, on Instagram and Facebook. And Russell Dickerson, the artist of that song, actually saw it and he reached out and he sent me some merchandise, and it was just so cool that he actually saw it. And then a couple months later, my parents said that we were having like an interview. And so, I mean, I was having a lot of interviews and stuff. So we got in front of the TV on a Zoom call, and Russell Dickerson came on the screen, and I just started freaking out. Because
this is the artist of your favorite song.
Yeah, I know. It was so cool. And he told me that day that he teamed up with Chevrolet and got me a brand new car, 2021 Chevy Traverse. And so he got me a car and it was out front in my driveway. And so he said, go look outside. And I lost it. It was so unreal. Like, it felt like a dream because it was like the happiest moment of my life. I asked a lot of questions after I found out my legs were gone, and I asked, will I be able to cheer? Will I be able to drive? You know,
what does life look like?
Yeah, exactly. And my mom just kept saying, yes, yes. Will I be able to swim? Yes. All the things. And so, I mean, driving, it's just with hand controls and now it's like second nature. I'm driving everywhere. So I have the car and it's fully outfitted for me. There's like a ramp that comes out for me to get in. And it's wow. It's so cool. So cool.
That's amazing. You know, from where you started to where you are now. What does life look like for you right now?
Right now, I just feel so happy, like, all the time. I find so much joy in the progression that I see in myself. Like, even today, I had been struggling with picking stuff up off the floor that were, you know, kind of heavy. But today, I finally was able to do it. And it just makes me so happy, like, even the littlest things. Like me learning how to sit up for the first time or roll over to my side. I had to relearn how to do everything. And so it makes me so happy when I finally am able to do the things that I had been struggling with. And so, yeah, right now I just find so much joy in the progression. I'm still doing physical therapy to help me get stronger. I still hang out with friends. I go swimming all the time.
Where do you think the strength comes from?
That's a hard question. I feel like, I don't know, because I feel like I'm the same person that I used to be, if not better. I don't know. I mean, my parents really help with my, like, mental strength. We talk about things all the time, which helps. I don't know.
Sometimes things are modeled to us in our family. You're the youngest of six, so big family. Growing up, how did you, this might be kind of a very much a shrinks question, but how did you observe older siblings or your parents handle adversity? Like, is there a family style for how to deal with problems? In your household, what did you see growing up?
Growing up, we definitely talk about things with each other when we were having conflicts rather than shutting people out, which I feel like helps. Like, I mean, as a teenager, you just want to go in your room all day and when you're mad, but I feel like we would always talk about things. And yeah, my older siblings are the biggest examples to me. I mean, I've already shared a story about my brother, and yeah, so yeah, I feel like we would just talk about
open things. Communication, yeah. And kind of feeling close. I'm not surprised that that would be part of your answer. That's because, and it should be sort of something that other people who are listening to the show, parents who are listening, that's a wonderful thing to model, because closeness comes after we communicate. Like an open communication style in a family binds people together. And when we feel bound together in our family, it is an encouraging, optimistic sort of way of feeling like I'm not alone. I'm going to be, I have this group that's,
yeah,
that's part of who I am. They want my success and I want their success. And I think that's a really neat style that we'll probably give credit to mom and dad for.
Yeah. Like having family dinners together every single night. That's what we would do, which is so cool because we would talk about things there and we would always have family dinners.
Communication is the key. You've always loved the fact that you're a cheerleader, and you said that you continue to cheer. You recently just did something with the rest of your cheerleaders. Tell me about that.
So last night actually was the last time I'll ever perform again with the cheerleading squad. We had our very last performance. It was just like a little showcase for the parents because we weren't allowed to have competitions this year. And so my team performed their what would have been their comp routine. And then the seniors of four different high schools performed the what they call the Sarah Strong dance, the dance to Home Sweet. So I was able to go out and perform with them, which was super, super fun.
You're tremendous.
You are such an inspiration. And I have seen a smile on your face since the moment I've met you. Greg, is she always this happy?
She actually really is. She, when she was in the hospital, we were bracing for these extreme lows that you hear people that have this kind of trauma will experience.
Like, which is really the norm. That's right. Typical.
Yeah. Right? And we had talked to some people, talked to some victims of other accidents that had left them paraplegic, and they had gone through long stretches, like a year or two of their life, where they were really in the dark depressions. So we were really bracing for that, and they were telling us, you got to be careful. Like, her mantra's kind of been Sarah Strong, but she's going to need to also know that she can be Sarah Sad and Sarah Mad and all that. But we've just and so she was posting on her social media, which just started to take off like crazy, and the face that you see on social media, that is her. When she goes through a bad period, it's like maybe 4 or 5 minutes, and then she pulls herself out somehow. I don't know how she's doing it. She can look at something like, she looks at her, like the example she gave about today, picking something up that was in the shower, and she picked something up off the out of the tub, and that was so huge for her. The choice she has is, I can either say, woe is me, or I can celebrate a small victory. I can look at my wheelchair and say, I hate this chair because it's so constricting and confining, and I'm confined to it. Or I can say, I'm so grateful for technology that gives me a wheelchair that allows me to go places. I'm so thankful for my wheelchair. She always takes that high road, that positive choice, when you have a choice, two choices to make.
I call that, and it's called optimism, right? And it's a personality trait. Has she always been an optimistic little person growing up in the household?
Yep, she has. And I think if parents knew how young in the lives of their kids they are learning about the modeling that you talked about, they're not listening to what you say. They're watching what you do. Parents would be amazed at how early on that stuff is taught.
It is.
How powerful of a message it is.
It's from the very beginning, and it's interesting. We have another optimist in the room, and that's Casey. I've brought that up a lot on this show. That's one of the reasons that people love to be around Sarah, and they love to be around Casey. Optimists do see the upside to everything, and they are fun, and they are inspiring to be around. You can feel it when you're around somebody that's truly an optimistic person. Most of us are somewhere in the middle on that bell-shaped curve, and we have a little optimism, we have a little pessimism, we struggle pushing one way or the other. But it's really neat to be around and inspiring to be around people that are true optimists.
Yeah, like you said, Casey's definitely an optimist. From right when I met you, I feel like we can our personalities would be so yeah, yes. You'd be my best friend.
We'd finish each other's. You're supposed to say sandwich.
Sandwiches.
Yeah,
sandwiches.
Yeah, coming down today, I was telling my dad, we were kind of talking about you and kind of what you're doing. And I was like, I feel like I would want you to be my driver, someone who would admit that, you know, because it would be a lot easier to forgive if my driver, you know, said sorry and stuff.
I think that's the biggest compliment you could possibly offer.
But it's so messed up that it's a compliment, because I should have never been in that situation. I never should have put myself or that family in the people that I hurt. I want to sit down with the people I hit. I hope one day to do so, because there's no excuse for drinking and driving. And I don't know. It is the most selfish thing you can do. And I did it. I did it a lot. And I look at you, and you shouldn't be in that chair. You shouldn't. And the fact that you're turning something so tragic into something so amazing makes me love you so much more. And I hope one day that I'll be able to talk to them, and I hope they will forgive me. But if they don't, I don't blame them. I really don't. You know, it's just, you shouldn't be there.
Have you, Sarah, can I ask if you've had any contact, conversation with the driver in your accident?
No, we have not. He has not reached out.
So the sentencing was Monday. That for us was a big milestone we've been waiting for, obviously, since this started. And these girls, so Josh is on a mission and he was zoomed in. So there were three girls in the courtroom. And the driver had a perfect opportunity twice and was even asked to come up and apologize and look these girls in the eyes. And that's what they wanted. They wanted him to just look at them and say, I'm sorry. And, but he didn't. And that's been a tough thing. We've been talking a lot about that since Monday, but I know restitution was a word that was used a lot in the courtroom. Mm-hmm. And Casey, I just got to say, you know, there's more to restitution than monetary reimbursement. There's what you're doing that shows so much. I mean, your restitution efforts are amazing. And if everybody that it was a DUI driver did what you're doing in whatever arena, you're playing to your strengths, if they would just do that to their strengths, serve society, pay, give back, and look at that as a way of restitution, can you imagine how much better society would be? So God bless you for what you're doing, and please look at that as you're going above and beyond in what you're doing.
I agree. And you know, emotional restitution is healing for both sides, of course. How has it been? Has it been hard for you, Sarah, knowing or having that experience of the driver not being willing to apologize? As far as your feelings of forgiveness and how you think about that person, what's been going on for you since Monday?
It just was so unexpected. I went in there confident that he would say sorry. So it just makes it hard to forgive. I know I want to eventually, once he comes forward and is able to face it like you, Casey, does. And
but I gotta stop you because I haven't had the opportunity yet to apologize to the people that I hurt. I want to, but when the accident happened in the beginning, they didn't want anything to do with me. I mean, I followed them on social and looked into it, and because of everything that was going on, I wasn't allowed to. And I remember saying on this podcast, you know, when we first started it, I said, I hope one day to be able to sit down and tell them I'm sorry. And I don't think sorry will ever be able to be said enough. And I want them to know that because of that, I'm doing this. And out of that tragedy became something good. And like, because I don't want people that are listening to this to think that I've done that, you know, because I haven't. And I want to. And hopefully this will get a conversation going where I can. But there's a chance that, you know, you were willing to hear it. There's a chance that the people I hit do not want to hear from me. And I don't blame them. I really don't, because forgiveness is not mine to give. It's them, you know.
Can you tell me a little bit about what you were thinking when either when the accident happened or when the sentencing occurred, or like what you were thinking?
Sure. When the accident happened, like you, I remember bits and pieces. I remember that I was done drinking, that I was done doing what I had been doing. I had negotiated. I had made promises to God, deals with the devil, to just to outthink this disease. And I tried everything I knew. And so I think I'm a pretty smart guy. And I threw everything I knew at it. And it always ended up with me still drinking. So I decided I was done. And I made that decision that day. And the next day I went into rehab and have never looked back. Not to say that I don't think about it, because I think we learn from our past. And I think about it every day. I think about the people I hurt every day, multiple times a day. So I went to rehab and did all that. And when I came out, it had been 45 days. And so I finally go to court and I didn't know what was going to happen. But I remember saying, whatever he says, I will do. Because that's what is asked of me. Yeah. And so I didn't do any jail time. Because they said that the 45 days, 53 days that I did in rehab. I didn't see my family for 45 days. And I'm not saying that's an excuse either way. You know what I mean? That's just what was given to me.
Yeah.
But had I had to go to jail, I would have done it. I'd have done it in a heartbeat.
Yeah.
And when you sit there and you talk about, you know, her resilience and her optimism and what they're going is that every day I'm living on borrowed time, because there's a chance that I could have killed somebody, that I could be in prison. and watching my daughters and my son grow up behind bars. And I can tell you, looking now, had I killed somebody, and this is just honest, we've never talked about this on this, I don't know if I could have lived with myself. I don't know how. Yeah. But then I don't know how I would do that and not be around for my kids. And so by the graces of God, I don't know how my situation ended up like this, but I'm grateful and I'll never take it for granted. I never will.
So I have a question, but let me first just for the record, just clarify. He did in his statement on Monday, in his written statement, his impact statement, he did say, I'm sorry that this happened to you. So he did say that.
Mm-hmm.
They're saying sorry, and then there's saying sorry. And his statement wanted, well, I don't want to get into the details of it. But
what I'm telling you is that actions speak louder for words than me.
Right.
And says I could have right out of that went and talked to him and said I'm sorry, but I had nothing behind me to back up what I was going to do. I feel confident now sitting in their living room talking to them and explaining to them how sorry I am. And I know sorry will never be able to solve it. But because of that, I haven't had a drink in close to 3 years. I started a podcast where we have people come on and talk about the recovery and show them that there's a different way, that maybe they don't have to hit a rock bottom.
Mm-hmm.
I speak at schools. I speak to parents. I work closely with the recovery community. So I can say that, look, yeah, it wasn't just words. There's actions behind what I'm doing. And I didn't feel confident right from the get-go to sit down because – is it just lip service? I didn't want it to be just lip service. I wanted to show them. And I can tell you, because of that family and the people that I hurt, they give me fuel. And I'm sad that they have to be my fuel, but they are. They make it easy when I say I don't want to drink, because I know where I could have been and I know where I want to be. And alcohol is not in it. And the fact that that happened forces me to be a better person and makes me want to be a better person.
Were you injured physically in the accident?
So I had a cut on my forehead and had 8 stitches. But much like you, I came to in a hospital, but I was handcuffed to a gurney with 2 officers guarding the door. And I've said it on this podcast before. I look over, and you've been in a hospital room for 75 days. You know, the silver napkin dispensers they have right there?
Mm-hmm.
I saw my reflection in the mirror, and I didn't recognize the guy looking back. I knew it was me because I was handcuffed to the chair. And it scared me that I didn't even recognize the person looking back at me. And I made a promise that day, and I make it every day, that I'll never be that person again. I don't want to be that person.
Yeah.
The world doesn't deserve that person. My kids don't deserve it, and I don't want to be that person.
Change is a really interesting thing to study, how people change, why they change. There's a real process to how people make significant, lasting, meaningful changes in their life. And I think, Sarah, you're obviously doing everything you can, like your dad said, playing to your strengths to move forward and be the optimistic, inspirational person that you are. And I think that maybe what we can hope for your driver is that somehow he engages in that process of change. And so that meaningful interaction that you hoped for this week didn't happen, but it might. And I think an optimist would assume that it could. And if it doesn't, you're going to keep moving forward anyway.
Yeah.
That's one thing, but
it could happen.
That's one thing I learned too. And I remember saying that, is that there's a lot of people out there that haven't forgiven me or won't forgive me. And that's okay, because that's their right. But I can't let that affect who I want to be. I don't want to carry that around with me. It's too heavy, and it doesn't serve me any purpose.
Yeah.
So I've got to be the best person I can for my kids, for my community, and move forward.
But I'll speak to those people, because you're right. It's their right. They're in their own process of life, and it's their life. But they will feel so much healthier and happier and live a richer, more meaningful life if they can find it in themselves to forgive. That is huge. And when we are unwilling to forgive others, it is a rock in your backpack. It weighs you down. It makes you live a heavier life than you need to. So if I could encourage somebody, whether they're related to your story, Sarah, or your story, Casey, or not, if you are having trouble forgiving someone, one of the most psychologically and emotionally healthy things you could do is figure out how to forgive.
But it's easier said than done. And I understand that. And I think it goes back to what your dad says, time. And you're going to figure out your path. And I'm amazed at your path already. I mean, in this short little time that you've been dealt this blow, you have done some amazing things. You have caused change. So much in the fact that your dad is talking with who later on today, and what are you guys trying to work on?
So it's legislation on a national level for the car manufacturers to implement the technology that we have that can prevent thousands and thousands. I mean, they estimate 9,500 deaths a year could be prevented by the technology that we currently are using in our cars. They just need to tweak it a little bit. And the manufacturers, that's what we're doing. We're going before Congress and trying to get sponsors for these bills. There's two bills, and if they can get the technology in the cars that can sense when driving is erratic or dangerous, the technology is there to save lives.
And it's already in a lot of cars, right?
Yeah,
it's an option. But what you're talking about is, why not make this a standard required safety measure, just like a seatbelt is?
Yeah.
I mean, I still got something in my car that I have to blow in it to start, and I haven't had a drink in over 2.5 years. I don't understand why those aren't standard in all cars. I mean, I used to be able to – I mean, as stupid as this sounds, Sarah, and I'm ashamed that I – like, you don't get to tell me what to do. But why can anybody choose to have alcohol and then drive? Look, if you want to drink, great. There's an Uber. There's a taxi. There's the train. There's a sober driver. But I want to hear one good reason why you should be able to drink and get behind a wheel, even the littlest bit.
Well, there isn't. There isn't. But
people will stand on their sword for that.
That's where people, and we've seen it a lot this year, people get hung up on the difference between individual rights and the rights of others. And I don't see, and I'm with you, Casey, I would vote for having that be a standard thing in everyone's car. I'd be happy to do that because look at the change that would make. You can't drive around without it.
I mean, Greg, you said what? You estimated 95,000 deaths a year?
9,500. I'm just getting involved with it, so I'm not sure on the statistics.
But one's too many.
But yeah. Yeah, but and I'm with you on the rights whole thing. Like, you know, we need government to stay out, but there are – when you have the technology there – and it's not even to the extent of having to blow into a device to check your BAC. It's just the technology is there to not hit the car in front of you. The technology is there to not go out of your lane, and the technology is there to for these self-driving cars. So, you know, it's after a certain number of sensing that you're not in control of your car to the extent you should be, it can literally pull that car over and turn the engine off. You know, and you think about that coming up 89, if your car at the time could have just pulled itself over and turned itself off.
And, you know, it's interesting because I'm normally a very calm person, I think.
Mm-hmm.
I think.
Unless we're talking about
not.
Masks.
But I lost it talking about masks and the individual rights and people who don't want to wear a mask and all of that sort of thing.
Vaccines.
Because vaccines, yeah, we won't go there today. But the idea is that we do have individual rights, but you also have to look at how your behavior affects your community and people around you. And at some point, we have an obligation to change our behavior to benefit the greater good. I remember being a little kid. My parents had, at that time, a very old white station wagon. I think it was a Buick. And it didn't even have seatbelts in the back because that wasn't a law back then. And we would roll around in the back and do all sorts of crazy things while my mom was driving. She, I'm sure, is traumatized by us as kids. But now, can you imagine buying a car without seatbelts? But there were people that said, it's all right. I shouldn't have to wear a seatbelt. We don't need to, you know, make seatbelts in all the cars. I think manufacturers back said, oh, it'll drive the cost up of these cars. We can't do it. But of course, that legislation is so far in the past that most people can't even remember a day when they made cars without seatbelts or without seatbelts in the back, or when you didn't have to wear a seatbelt. And hopefully someday in the future, we're having a similar conversation where this sort of technology is just so standard to keep people safe. It would be amazing. And so thank you for spending your time trying to advocate for that technology.
Let's go back to Sarah and her pretty blue nails. So
just got them done.
They look absolutely beautiful. So where does Sarah go from here?
Well, I mean, it's crazy to think it's only been 9 months. Like, when I was in the, or thinking about when I was in the hospital feels like forever ago. So, I mean, it's almost summertime. I'm graduating this year. We'll have a fun summer. My brother, who I was talking about earlier, he is actually on a mission for our church. And so he'll get home at the very beginning of June. So he'll be able to come home and we'll have a fun summer. And then I'm going to Utah State University and studying elementary education, where I want to become an elementary school teacher. So
wonderful. Wow.
I think you can do whatever you put your mind to, because what you've accomplished in
I would have loved to have you as my elementary school teacher.
That's amazing.
I had a few doozies that I still remember.
I had Miss Astle.
Ooh.
That was her name.
That sounds tough. I had an elementary school teacher that we were finger painting one day, and she came up and ripped mine off the easel and crumpled it up and threw it away and said, try again. That's a true story.
Yeah, I've always wanted to be an elementary school teacher. Like, when I was in elementary school, I would look around and like picture things in my classroom. And so it's so cool to be able to say that I can still do that. Like, that's something I can
Well, think
totally
about
still
all
do.
The generations of people you'll be able to influence. A good teacher in our lives is hard to replace. A good teacher is everything. Talk about modeling and encouragement, and you're primed for your personality to be somebody who will just make a difference in hundreds, if not thousands, of kids' lives. So I think that's a
Thank
wonderful
you.
Choice.
Well, I want to say thank you very much to you, Sarah, and Greg, for stopping by today and sharing your story. If people wanted to follow you on Instagram, is that something you want?
Yeah, sure.
Yeah.
So it's strong.like.sarah. So strong like Sarah.
I love it. And you are amazing. I'm going to give you a hug. I know it's not appropriate during COVID, but I don't care. You've been listening to Project Recovery. It's brought to you by knowyourscript.org. And don't forget, Project Recovery is a KSL podcast.
Of this program are for informational purposes only. The program is not intended to be a substitute for professional medical advice, diagnosis, or treatment. Always seek the advice of your physician, licensed therapist, or other qualified health provider with any questions you may have regarding a medical condition. Never disregard professional medical advice or delay in seeking it because of something you've heard on this program. KSL does not recommend or endorse any specific tests, physicians, products, procedures, opinions, or other information that may be mentioned on the program. Reliance on any information provided on the program is solely at your own risk.
A gun in the face.
Then all of a sudden they all kind of lined up. They pointed their guns at me. And this is the point where I thought, I'm going to die today.
Started 2 years of horror for an American in Venezuela.
They said, you need to give us your phone and get ready because you're coming with us.
I'm Becky Bruce, and I spent a year researching and piecing together Josh and Tammy Holt's story about their ordeal in a notorious prison.
That's when everything started to turn bad. We had another pound on the door. Boom, boom, boom. And there was the police once again.
You can binge all of the episodes of Hope and Darkness on KSLpodcasts.com. or wherever you get your podcasts.